It's so very important to see myself as I really am, to see myself as God sees me. Because when I don't see myself as God sees me, then I hide. And the result is that I become a person who is blind, and I become a person who communicates something that I'm not to other people.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
I was talking about our situation when we were taping this radio program a couple of weeks ago, and I had asked you for an example from your own life of some failure, and because that fit within the context of what we were talking about. And I don't think people would have known this, because our techer who edits all our tapes probably edited it so that we couldn't see that what you did was stop, and gosh, it must have taken you 30 to 60 seconds to come up with a failure, and then you came up with one that was something that happened 20 years ago. And I thought about that all week, and I thought, my heavens, Jack doesn't see himself as a failure. And then because you had given one that was so in the future, though it was a great example and very instructive, I wanted something more in the present. But you did the same thing. You stopped and you thought for about a minute, a long time, and then you came up with a good example, but it was rather general. And I came back this week and said, wait a minute, Jack, what's going on here? Do you not see yourself as a failure? Are you not seeing specific examples of what's going on? So, Jack, you gave a great explanation of what was going on there. Can you say that again on right now?
Why don't you recount it?
Yeah, you forget. That's a great way to pass the ball back to me. You said, oh, well, I can come up with some examples, but I think it's really obvious that everybody struggles in those ways, and they're not very instructive. They're just so mundane. And right. I said, but Jack, you've got to talk about the mundane areas of life, like how you yelled at your wife, or how you were impatient with your children, or how you're so angry at certain situations in your life and you're not dealing with them well. And you said, well, I don't do that because, well, everybody knows that we all struggle. And, well, of course, my answer is, of course, I yell at my wife sometimes. I don't know if that's exactly the way we put it, but, well, of course. And I said, well, Jack, that's not a well, of course. So many people come into my counseling office and they say, I am the only one who is like this. I failed again. I yelled at my child. I cheated at work. I got mad at my spouse. I gave in when I shouldn't have. I misled somebody in this way. And they're small things, perhaps, that happen in life, but they happen, and people think that other people outside of them aren't doing that kind of stuff. They really think they're the ones that are failing, and because nobody really talks about their failures, that they're the only ones. And that's such a huge thing for me to work with. I am constantly needing to tell people my failures. But you know what happens is people think then, oh, how can you possibly be my counselor? Because you're failing
you're
just like
person.
Me. You're bad like me. Well, the deal is we're all doing these failures, but nobody is coming out of the closet and saying them.
Huh.
And do you have anything to say about that before
I
go on?
I have to confess that I really am out of touch with that perception and that reality and that mentality in our culture. It surprises me that it's that entrenched. I mean, I could imagine that there are people out there who have a kind of what I ultimately would have to say is a naive view that being a really good person is accessible to us. is possible for us.
Their naive view, you would say, is that they don't think everybody struggles with these things.
Right.
You
yeah.
thought everybody knew that Recognize everybody
that.
Else was struggling.
Yeah. Or
at they
least
don't.
At least that the vast majority of people do.
They don't.
Okay. Yeah. See, I that startles me.
I think that's a naive view to think
right.
that you would think that people know that everyone else is failing like them. People don't know that everybody else is failing like them. They look around at the exterior of people's lives, which everybody shows, and think, man, I am the only failure around here. Everybody else has got a whole lot more in line than I do. They don't do this, they don't do that, and they have a very difficult time then being honest with themselves and being honest with other people because they think they're just going to be obliterated because they're so weird, because they're so bad, because they're so different.
Help me here a little bit.
I'm trying to help you, Jack.
Yeah, yeah. How does a person who has that view, how do they view the obvious selfishness, pride, greed, thoughtlessness of the people that are interacting with them? I mean, do they not see it? Do they assume that somehow they're to blame for it and that it's not a failing on the part of the other people?
Both.
Both of those.
They don't see it. They might turn it around and say, well, it's excusable because of this or that. Or they might think, it's my fault that they're that way. The reason our relationship isn't working is because I am just the one that's a mess.
Hmm.
They may see it, what's going on with other people, and dismiss it. I think it takes some pretty big gymnastics. But what is screaming, what people are screaming is, and often what people only see, is this scream that's the shined up exterior of their lives. I am working, all of us are working so hard for you to see the good part of me, and that's so in front of us, and it's so pressed, and it's kind of intimidating to even look beyond what looks so good about you, because you want me to see that's what I end up seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow that?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking the other day, it occurred to me, there's a kind of piety that you see in the Christian culture today that I don't find at all attractive. I mean, it's very unattractive to me. But I had to stop my show.
Could you explain what you mean, a kind of piety? What are you describing exactly?
Well, boy, it's hard. I mean, I wish I just could have a videotape of somebody talking to illustrate what I'm talking about. But it extends to everything from the tone of voice that's being used to the subject matter talked about, the vocabulary that we use. It's obviously very calculated to communicate my love of God, my devotion to God, my spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of calculated to exude spirituality.
As they define it.
As they understand it and define it, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't find it at all attractive. And the reason I don't find it at all attractive is because I have been there. I have been that person. I know what's driving that. I know how inauthentic it is.
What was driving it?
Utterly phony. Basically a strong passion to want to be able to perceive myself as a really acceptable to God kind of person. That I was superior. I was spiritually superior person. Because I loved God and I was committed to Him and to living my life by His principles, and it's what the New Testament calls self-righteousness.
Kind of trying to present yourself as someone extra special.
Yeah.
And maybe
yeah.
it came out of a sense of not feeling very extra special and needing to pump yourself up.
Yeah, probably.
And man, that really gives you a special edge, doesn't it? If you think if God is on your side, then. You know, if you're really, really spiritual, then you're kind of a big, huge notch above most people.
Yeah. I really identified it. Really, I might have mentioned this on this program before, but when early in my Bible study and Bible teaching career, I looked at the parable of the Pharisee and the sinner. And the phrase that Luke introduces that with just stuck out like a sore thumb and just really speared me. Because it says, and Jesus told this parable to those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt.
Hmm.
that, especially that viewed others with contempt part, really speared me, because I realized that's me. I've spent a lot of my life patting myself on the back, looking down my nose at all those morally inferior people out there that don't have the same principles that I live by, and are licentious and are fornicators and are cheaters and thieves, and they just have no moral fiber, unlike me with my strong moral fiber. And I just realized how contemptuous I had been. And that was the first little nudge in the direction of coming to face to face with my own self-righteousness. But I, you know, I was clueless before that. I wasn't self-righteous, I was righteous. Mm-hmm. That's what I was.
Mm-hmm. You saw it for the opposite of what it was.
Pardon?
You saw it in an opposite way than what was really true.
Yeah. Instead of this incredible self-deceit, I thought it was just an objective appraisal of my own inherent moral worth. So anyway, I mean, my point was, I came to realize, in a way, how out of touch I am with my own history and with the culture out of which I came and the mentality that has to persist out there. But I'm sort of out of touch with it because I take it for granted that everybody knows that kind of piety is inauthentic. Everybody knows that that's false. Everybody knows that that's not to be emulated, that we should be fleeing from that with all of our might. But I realized, no, not everybody does know that.
No, it's like when you were doing that, you didn't know that it was wrong. You didn't see it. You thought, were convinced that it was absolutely right. And I'm sure that there are people that are listening right now that are angry at you and I because we're, I think a word you used earlier, I interrupted you, but you said it seems phony. I don't think that it was phony to you at the time because you thought it was authentic. And when people are doing it, they don't see it as phony. They see it as authentic. And I think, you know, certainly Christians have a theology that says we're sinners. But very often, Jack, and we were talking about this in our last program, that's only theory. It doesn't come out of wisdom of life, of really seeing and working at life differently, or seeing ourselves differently. It really it's just something that remains in our head as a theological reality. But I think we're making a huge mistake if we think that most people really think that other people are like them, or that lots of people see their own sin very clearly. I know I have been very blinded in my own sin, as this example you gave in your own life. And so when we communicate to other people, we're not communicating out of lots of times knowing that we're blundering, like you were in your example. We're communicating out of thinking we really got it together, and other people are seeing that. They believe that, because we believe that. It's convincing.
Yeah. Well, just to set the record straight, my life is filled, literally filled, with what I would consider to be moral failures, impatience, thoughtlessness, even cruelty, selfishness. The biggest struggle of my life in recent years has been in the arena of my attitude toward my unbelief, really, my failure to embrace the truth about what's important and what's not important in relationship to my children's athletic pursuits. That's a big part of their lives and therefore a big part of my life. And the world of sports, of competitive team sports, is a microcosm of the bigger world. All the injustice, all of the subjective appraisals and decisions of people that has a huge emotional and psychological impact on other people. I mean, it's just a focal point of real life there in microcosm. Mm. And yet it's unimportant. I mean, in the larger scheme of things, it's really not very important. But I am constantly losing that perspective. And I get angry and I get resentful and I get bitter and I say all kinds of nasty things that I shouldn't be saying about people, that's very unkind about them, very unjust, very unloving. And, you know, that's the normal life for me, is to be basically fundamentally a very weak and sometimes a miserable jerk in my attitudes and actions and words and so on. But I don't find that particularly remarkable anymore. I mean, there probably would have been a time when maybe I would have, but I know, I believe the Bible enough to know that there isn't anybody out there who can claim better than that. I know that that's true. So, on the one hand, I'm very shamed about by who it is that I am, on the one hand. On the other hand, if we're grading on the curve, hey, I'm not doing any worse than anybody else. Because I know that as much as people may spiffy up the outside of their life to make it look pretty good, I know that there's stuff beneath the surface that they're not letting me see. I just know it. Because I know human beings now. I think that's part of the wisdom that I have gained through years and years of Bible study, is I've really come to believe that the Bible is telling it like it is. And what it's telling me is, Jack, all those things that rage within you are raging in their soul as well. They just are.
And Jack, you know, that it's such a freeing thing for you to know that.
Oh, absolutely.
It's such a hugely freeing thing. And it's a hugely freeing thing for me to know that. But just think about the people who don't know that. They are absolutely incarcerated in their shame, incarcerated in their guilt. It's awful. They live an awful existence.
There's probably a lot of things that we need to say in terms of, you know, what do they do and how do they need to look at their life differently. One of them that's important, it's probably not the only thing, but one of them that's important is that we really need to come to terms with the mercy of God and take it seriously. I think one of the factors that kept me trapped in my self-righteousness as long as I was, is that if I were to admit that I was as bad as I actually was, mm-hmm. wouldn't God reject me?
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's what people think.
Yeah.
Not wouldn't God reject me, but they're gambling for sure he would.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just too far. It's too much. Yeah, well, they've already looked at 10 failures in their life, but to look at 10 more, 20 more, 30 more, it just isn't going to work. And they're plowed under when they start looking at stuff and when God's mercy isn't really clear to them. And I know I've said this a gazillion times on the show, but I think a lot of times the mercy is not obvious to people because they have not experienced mercy from other people and they can't imagine it. Hmm. They have experienced hurt from other people so much. You know, and it scares me lots of times, Jack, when I was radically PMSing this last week and I got so mad at my daughter a bunch of times. And, you know, sitting back, I think, how is that little girl going to know about mercy when I just got so mad and so angry and let you use the word cruel? I mean, downright cruel in my attitude toward her. How could you do this again kind of attitude, which is so demeaning and so hurtful, and I just hate it. On one hand, I know that you do that with your children and that everybody else does that with their children. But I don't want to hurt my daughter. I don't want to hurt my children, or I don't want to hurt anybody. And yet I am. And so in this discussion, we're not saying that we're this way and it doesn't mean anything. We're this way, and part of being a believer, part of the sanctification is that it really does matter to us and that we work hard at it not being that way. We work hard at seeing where we're wrong and trying as hard as we can not to do it. And when we see that we've done it, go back and make amends. Go back and try and work with it. And not dig a hole and put the dirt on top of us and say, okay, I'm only worthy to be buried now or to be put in hell now. That's
beat ourselves up emotionally over the...
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the things that I have done in the past that I think is an indication of how seriously I take this, and I don't think I take it seriously enough because I don't do this enough, but it's important to me when I have been cruel and thoughtless and impatient with my children that I go to them and help them understand, help them look at what I am and who I am. I'm inviting them, I'm welcoming them to see what I have done as wrong and inappropriate and out of bounds and sinful, evil. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's use those words. Mm-hmm. Children, I want you to understand that my behavior was evil. And that's not easy for a father to do. I mean, that takes a certain amount of... I mean, it's kind of humiliating at times. And I should do it more than I do it. Pardon?
Kind of very humiliating.
Yeah, it's very humiliating.
And, you know, a problem also is the balance of... I want to say, and I think you're saying, I want to humble myself. Want to. I think it's right. And then do say where I was wrong. But then it's not an excuse for the child to then say, oh, well, it doesn't matter what they did.
Right.
And so that's kind of I think that's what stops people a lot is, well, if I say this, then they're going to think that it's okay that they did that.
Yeah.
So.
I sometimes we'll talk about both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the evil at work in both of us? The evil was at work in what you did, and the evil was at work in the way I responded to it. And that's our enemy. That's the enemy of every human being. That's why God has come to save us, to rescue us. That's what he's rescuing us from. I mean, it's a tremendous opportunity to teach the biblical truth about life and human experience. But I pass it up far too often. I'm just too lazy. And that's another failure. I mean, I should take those opportunities and really use them to let them see through my eyes out of the wisdom that God is giving me. Let them see what life looks like through that.
You know, in a very practical way, that what that does to children is help with this one obstacle that we were talking about in the beginning, is then to see other people are like them.
Right.
If my dad is like this, oh, then maybe other adults are that way. Then maybe I'm not the only one. But if we don't talk to our children, then our children come to think, oh, I'm just the one that's messed up.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jack, we're in this series, in the midst of a series of looking at what's it look like for me to be a believer. And it's having a growing understanding of myself. And one of the things that I'm growing to understand is the depth of my own sinfulness. And that's what we've been talking about today, or in the last few minutes.
Right.
But I think people could be asking, wait a minute, is that all I get? That's so discouraging. That's so negative. Is that what God wants me, just to kind of wallow in what's negative and wrong about me?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because... it's really sort of a dual truth that we need to keep in view at the same time. On the one hand, I'm a remarkable creature, a remarkable creation, the most remarkable creature of all the creatures that God has created. And the way the Bible gets at that is to say that as human beings, we are created in the image of God. It's something that's said about us that's not said about any other aspect of God's creation. And in that sense, we are unique. I mean, we are the top
of creation.
Ontologically speaking, I mean, in terms of our being, in terms of our creatureliness, we're as good as you can get. And I really think that's what the Bible is saying. On the one hand. On the other hand, we are morally unworthy, when that's what we have been talking about over the last few
minutes. Trying to be explicit and detailed about how we are morally unworthy, because that gets passed over a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a sinner, everybody sinned and falls short of the glory of God, and then we go on. And talking about these moral failures is really, I think, what people need to hear a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
But also what is happening, though, God has given us the eyes to see that we're this way. Again, I love your example where you went from being this self-righteous person who really thought you were at the height of your spirituality, and he changed you so that you can see that's not what it was about. I was self-righteous. I was deceived. I was blind. And now I see who I am. I see this aspect of myself as being really wrong, really self-righteous, really hurtful to other people, in that I was contemptuous. I wasn't being kind and caring. I was being hurtful. And that's part of what God does with us as believers. He helps us see.
Right.
Another thing that he does is, I think, in our seeing, there is then some opportunity to extend grace and love and acceptance to other people. And it is out of that seeing that we have these better relationships with people, because they're not different than us. I can't have as much contempt for my daughter when I see that my behavior is as bad as hers. And so there is this developing acceptance of others and compassion for others and ability to forgive others, which does build and enhance and grow relationships. It is the centerpiece of the growth of relationships.
Right.
How about, though, if we kind of turn the page and look at the other aspect? How am I a remarkable creation? What does it really look like, Jack, to be made in the image of God? I mean, we've said all this really yucky stuff. What's the good stuff about us?
Most people, maybe some people have had life experiences that make this difficult, but most people have experienced other people in their kindness, in their generosity, in their warmth, in their nobility, and they've stood back and go, wow, that's neat. It makes it all worthwhile. Human beings can be really beautiful creatures when we are being human in the way God created human beings to be. We're the kind of people that we could hang around with for eternity and really enjoy, really find rewarding experience. We spoil that because of our selfishness and our pride and our greed and just all the manifestations of evil in our heart. We kind of spoil it. And so human experience becomes a kind of bittersweet experience. We're not sure if we want it or don't want it. It promises so much because there's so much potential there on the one hand. On the other hand, sin makes it so futile because it's always destroyed and sabotaged by evil. It's hard to define what the beauty of a human being is because I think it's so multifaceted. Theologians debate, what does it mean that we're made in the image of God? And they say, well, it's our rationality, or it's our ability to use language, or it's our aesthetic sense, the fact that we have some idea about beauty, or it's our moral sense, the fact that we distinguish between right and wrong, good and bad, and so on. In my judgment, the moral sense is a very, very important, if not the most important, aspect of what it means to be made in the image of God. That is, we are moral creatures. That is, we live our lives in terms of right and wrong, good and bad. A grizzly bear doesn't. An alligator doesn't. You know, an alligator never stops to think, would it be right for me to eat that person or that fish? They just do. They're kind of organic robots, organic computerized devices. We are not that. We are free moral agents. And in that regard, we reflect the character of God in a way that nothing else in creation does. Or at least, I don't know about angels, but anything that we're familiar with every day. But I'm inclined to think that being created in the image of God is actually multifaceted, and that all those theologians are right. Our language puts us apart. The degree and nature of our rationality sets us apart. Our aesthetic sense sets us apart. I think all of those things make us unique and special and amazing and magnificent creatures that are kind of godlike within this creation in all of those respects. And then we can go beyond that to speak of our individuality, not just as a species, I mean, not just as a kind of being am I a magnificent being, but I would go so far ultimately to say that God has created us as individual people, as having our own kind of glory, our own individual kind of glory, where we are just a remarkable individual, as God created me to be. My sin sabotages it, but the basic unit that God created me to be is really quite remarkable and amazing.
How so?
Just in the context of my marriage, for example, there are certain things that I have come to they're really kind of subtle, and if you didn't know the person well, you probably wouldn't even necessarily know them or acknowledge them or notice them. But I just get a lot of joy every now and then when I watch my wife at work. She's just an incredibly naturally thoughtful person. And what I mean by that is creatively thoughtful. She, when she does something kind for someone, it really is ingeniously kind.
You have this twinkle in your eye.
Yeah. Well, it's just a delight to watch it. It's a joy because it's something I really am not capable of doing. I mean, there's a sort of genius to it that comes naturally to her that I couldn't even match even if I worked at it. I mean, even if I practiced it.
Well, you know what came to mind? Something that I had actually forgotten about, but when we moved to town here about 9 years ago, we were staying in a hotel for a while. No, we had come up to look at houses to buy. And in our hotel room was a large basket, really beautiful basket, full of stuff for us. And it was from Jody.
Yeah.
It was from Jack and Jody.
Yeah.
But I think it was
really
from Jody. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And I was so taken by that, so pleased by that. It was such a welcome to Eugene. Mm-hmm. And it felt so personal and so warm. And I think that's what you're talking
about.
That's
what I'm talking about, yeah.
That's a characteristic of her.
Yeah. And I think to a large extent she would be that way quite apart from spiritual maturity or... It's a creaturely trait that God has given her, and it gets filled in by wisdom and spiritual maturity, and can get sabotaged by sin as well. But there's something that God has created in her that's just really a delightful thing for a creature to be. You meet other people where, I mean, I have another friend who's just so naturally articulate, so naturally eloquent.
That must be me. You're laughing.
Yeah, let's assume so.
Yeah.
He lives on the other side of the country now, but it's just I just marvel at he can say the simplest thing, but you're just captivated by the way he said it because it's just so naturally eloquent. Well, there's nothing that's not going to commend him to God. You know, God is not going to say, enter into my eternal kingdom because you're so eloquent. I mean, it really doesn't count for anything in the ultimate, in the overall scheme of things. It's not that important. But it's just this little creaturely thing that God has created in him that is really kind of delightful to behold. Mm-hmm. That a person could be that good at something or that could excel that much at something. And I think every individual has those little packages of genius.
Isn't that what draws us?
To people. Yeah. Right.
And we may not be able to describe it. If we stop and somebody asks, like last week in counseling, somebody said, tell me what it is about me that makes me unique.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great question because I had to sit back and just kind of think about it. And I didn't come up with really profound, magnificent stuff. I came up with what makes that person uniquely them and what actually draws me to them. And with this particular person, what drew me to them is the part that they try so hard to hide from everybody. And they said, what? You like that about me? You're kidding. No, I love that about you. I don't like the polished part that you're showing to everybody, particularly. I don't really trust it. But what I really like is this other stuff that's so, for this person, so refreshingly... just so refreshingly beautiful in my eyes. And and I think if we stopped and looked at people individually and really described it, I think we'd come up with these unique things that we're talking about that are oftentimes quite simple. It's part
of what... And very subtle, usually.
Very, very subtle. Well, you know, I think one of the things that drew me to my husband was his perception of me. He said that I was the sunshine of his life. I had not thought about myself as being a sunshine, as being a ball of fun and energy that just brought delight to somebody's life. But he found delight in me. And it's wonderful to have these things that people enjoy, that they see in me, and that I enjoy in seeing them.
Right, right. I can remember early in my marriage, it at a moment of insecurity or something, my wife would ask me, what do you like about me? Or tell me something that's special about me or something.
There was one time she probably verbalized it but she, like all of us, probably have many moments of insecurity.
Yeah. And early in my marriage, it was virtually impossible for me to articulate that. And I felt so horrible because it's not that I didn't believe it. It's that I hadn't analyzed it. You know? Yeah. I couldn't articulate it because I hadn't analyzed it. And now I think if she were to ask me that same question, I could articulate some things. I mean, these are really, really important special aspects of who you are. But it's taken me years of watching it to be able to analyze it. And that's how subtle our virtues are, that genius, that magnificence of our individual creation can be, is that God is a very subtle creator. And we just don't have the words, the categories for easily analyzing those kinds of things.
Or maybe we just don't take the time sometimes.
And sometimes we don't take the time and don't have enough experience with, mm-hmm. with a lot of people to be yeah. able to do that.
Yeah. But wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to do for people, is to really look, mm-hmm. to really pay attention, mm-hmm. and to say to them, this is what I see about you, and this is what I really, really do like about you. It
right.
draws me to you.
Yeah.
And some of the things that draw me to people aren't things that they might necessarily even like to know about themselves. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes people can even take it as a negative, you
right.
know.
Right.
Like I was talking to someone last week and saying that they were refreshingly naive. Well, to me, I just love it because they're so
without guile.
Yeah, without guile.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love it. I feel trusting of them because of it. I think what they say is true, is right, and they're not going to try and pull the wool over my eyes. That's a really nice thing about them.
Right.
I would trust them with my life.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in that particular one is, I think this is the only instance that I can think of in the Bible where Nathaniel is described by Jesus, "Behold, the Israelite in whom there is no guile."
Huh.
I mean, then he just points that feature out of in him.
And it's not always that this person is completely honest or doesn't make a
right.
lot of mistakes in that regard.
Right.
Yeah, it does get contaminated, but underneath it, there's this really neat thing, and I really like them. I'm really drawn to them
yeah.
because of that. And I think we might be drawn to more people if we were really looking for those areas and trying to see them more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the point in all this is that are we sinners? Yes, we are sinners. But who is it that are sinners? The people that are sinners are these magnificent creations who are not a pile of garbage. We're not pond scum. We are not, we're not despicable as creatures. We are morally unworthy as creatures, but we're not despicable junk. And people often don't make that distinction. And psychologically and emotionally, especially, they don't make that distinction. So they think that if I confess my sinfulness, if I allow myself to see myself as a sinner, it's tantamount to thinking of myself as pond scum or worse.
Right.
And they don't recognize that no one's ever asked you to see yourself as pond scum. In fact, it would be evil of you to do so. It would be sinful and rebellious of you to see yourself as pond scum because it's not true. God, your creator, created you to be a magnificent creature. And the truth is that you need to acknowledge that. If you won't acknowledge that, you're rebelling against the truth.
So we need to acknowledge both.
Yeah, we need to acknowledge both, exactly.
And how does God view us?
How does God view us?
Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of times we view ourselves as, I don't know if this is an okay radio word, but I remember having a client about 20 years ago. She used to call herself a scumbag. And mm-hmm. I think that kind of says it all. Would God see her as a scumbag? I mean, she did make a lot of mistakes. She was really hurtful and cruel toward other people. Is that how God sees her?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between, are we speaking in the moral realm? Then probably any nasty word we want to use to describe ourselves would be appropriate. Morally, yes, we are despicable morally. I'm not sure an easy, convenient word to use here. Ontologically is the word I would use as a philosopher. But in my creatureliness, in my created being that I am, as the creature that I am I despicable? No. God doesn't see me that way. He sees me as the apex of his creation. I mean, I think the thing that we have to keep in mind is one of the things that you see, a theme in the New Testament, is in Colossians, for example, it's not always translated this way, and so people might miss it in their English translation, but I'm convinced from the Greek text that what he's saying is the whole, all of creation was created with Jesus in view, with the Son in view. And that point gets made two or three or four times in the New Testament, that what is this creation all about? To give a reality for the Son to dwell in. Well, one of the things that is implied by that is that there would be no world, there would be no created reality that we live in if God had not decided, I'm going to become a human being. You know, he has this plan. I'm going to incarnate as a particular creature. In fact, I'm going to incarnate as a human being in particular, and I need a world for him to live in. So let's create the cosmos, the physical universe, and the whole history of that universe. I'm going to do that, the whole thing. Why am I doing all that? I need a place for my Son to live in. Who's the Son? It's me, incarnated in a creature that I'm going to make. Well, that has incredible implications. What that means is, I belong to that species of creatures, that kind of creatures, that God determined he would incarnate in. He was going to become one of me. And the New Testament does not miss that point, it seems to me. It's dwelling on the point that's how significant being a human being is that I'm among the creatures. I'm a brother and sister to that creature who is actually God himself, God incarnate. Well, that's how important what I am is. The author of Hebrews goes so far as to argue that makes me more important than the angels, even though they are in many respects more powerful as creatures, a higher level, a higher order of being, whatever they are, than me. Nonetheless, I am more important than they are. Why? Because when did God ever become an angel? Incarnate as an angel? He just hasn't. He incarnated as a human being. Well, we have to capture the vision of that. I mean, we have to let that penetrate into my heart and my emotions and realize whatever it is that God thinks of me, he doesn't reject me as a creature. He thinks I'm the apex of his creation. And as an individual, I'm an important member of the apex of this kind of being that's the apex of his creation. Morally, I stink, and that's got to be fixed. Morally, I'm unworthy. Morally, I really deserve to be punished. In an ironic kind of way, the fact that I deserve to be punished is a compliment. I mean, if I were just a piece of junk that was morally, morally fallen, morally broken, if I was just a piece of junk, then all that I would deserve is just to be obliterated and be done with and ignored, because I'm nothing anyway. I started off being nothing, and now I'm broken nothingness. Well, I'm not broken nothingness. I'm something more important than anything else in the world that's broken, and that needs to be dealt with. That needs to be confronted, and that's what the whole story of salvation is, wrath or mercy.
I think what you're saying is that, like with my children, it's a compliment to them that I would want to help them, to correct them, to because they matter to me. I don't work as hard, nearly as hard, with any other person's children. Right. And that's how God is toward all of us.
Right.
We're his children, and it's a compliment that he would want to work with us, to discipline us, in order to grow in maturity. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a really hard thing.
Yeah.
You know, as you're talking, Jack, what occurs to me is, it's, why didn't God just let us be these morally good people? I really like that side a whole lot better. You know, I think if I was God with my limited understanding, I wouldn't have this moral corruptness. It seems so unnecessary for God to have done that. Now, I believe in my head that it's got to be necessary or he wouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
But do you get it? It's mm-hmm. just, I don't know why he did it this way.
Yeah, if he's going to end with the kingdom of God, why didn't he just create the kingdom of God from the get-go and be done with it?
Not make us go through all this. Because
yeah.
he could have made us morally beautiful people.
He could have, yeah.
So it's really kind of confusing to me as we're talking here. And
well, because we're running out of time, I'm not sure we can explore that fully. Maybe in the future we should raise that question again and explore it in full. But my short answer is, I think it has to probably it must have to do with the fact that since the story he's telling in the cosmos is a story of redemption, that there was something about his mercy, his desires and passions to redeem that he wanted to make manifest through the story of this created reality.
But it's such a hard created reality, you know?
It is hard.
Life is tough.
Yeah, it's very tough.
Even at its best. So, I mean, on one hand, I can think, yeah, I can understand that God wanted to communicate that. But it really doesn't take away from the reality that life is tough. So, Jack, let's sum up what we said today, since our time is just about up.
Basically, there's two aspects of what we are trying to communicate today. That in my sanctification, I have to grow into an understanding of the truth about who I am. And two aspects of that we're talking about today is, on the one hand, my magnificence as a creature. I am a remarkable creature. I'm a noteworthy creature that is not a piece of junk. I'm not garbage. I'm not pond scum. I am the apex of God's creation in terms of the kind of creature that I am. And as an individual, I'm a special member of that class of creatures, uniquely created by Him with my own unique glory, my own unique genius to me. And I really think I need to come to that understanding. If I reject that out of a kind of self-hatred, why would we reject, if I'm so remarkable, why would I reject that? Because I want to be somebody else. And in my temper tantrum, my rebellion, my resistance to God being in control of my life, I think I would rather be better than I am. I'm not good enough. And so since I'm not good enough, I'm going to reject who I am. And we resort to a kind of self-hatred. Well, that self-hatred is just wrong. It's rebellious. It's sinful. There's nothing justified about it, and there's nothing right about it. It's just completely wrong. Well, as I grow in my sanctification, I grow away from self-hatred into a kind of profound self-acceptance, where I'm willing to see and acknowledge the good person that I am. But the other aspect of who I am that we come to a fuller understanding of is my moral unworthiness. In terms of my morality, I am evil, I am sinful, I am selfish, I am greedy, I am everything that I should not be. I'm fully capable of horrendously evil things. And there's maybe in the future we can talk more about that. There's probably more that can be said about that, but a growing understanding of the depth and profundity of my own sinfulness is something that will happen as I become sanctified.
And I think I'd like to add that the paradox of understanding the depth of my own sinfulness actually is what frees me.
Frees you from...
from having to hide.
So yeah, from having to hide and beat myself up, self-flagellation.
Right.
In his article, Treasuring These Things in Our Hearts, Jack Crabtree reflects on two aspects of the Christmas story that just don't make sense. On the one hand, the birth of Jesus is accompanied by a dramatic fanfare of angels singing, ordinary people prophesying as to Christ's identity and significance, and wise men traveling from the other side of the world to do homage to him. On the other hand, when Jesus begins his public ministry years later, he emerges from relative obscurity to present himself to a skeptical nation that didn't seem to have the slightest idea who he was and what he had come to do. How can the public be so utterly without a clue as to who Jesus is when God made it so clear with events surrounding his birth? In this article, Jack discusses how easy it is to believe that Jesus is the promised king because a whole chorus of angels are singing his praises in a dramatic display of divine power. However, it is much more difficult to believe that Jesus is the promised king when life's circumstances are closing in on you, when you have lived for years with no solutions to your most urgent problems, when angels are conspicuously silent, when God seems so far away, so preoccupied, and so deaf, and when no signs in the heavens are telling you anything at all. Jack stresses that if we believe deeply and profoundly within our own hearts that what is transpiring at Christmas is the most important thing the world will ever know, then truly we have come to believe in the importance of Christmas. Call the McKinsey Study Center for your free copy of the article, Treasuring These Things in Our Hearts, by Jack Crabtree.
Jack, in thinking about asking people for support of this ministry, Christianity at Work, to enable us to continue on, I've thought about you receiving all your income from support. We're asking for support in the same way for our programming here. How do you justify that in your own life?
I mean, how did I justify the whole idea of living off of support of other people?
Yes.
Well, it was hard. I mean, I've received a lot of criticism over the years. A number of relatives have said to my parents, when is Jack going to get a real job? And, you know, I think what they mean by that is, when is he going to stop living off of charity, you know, living off of the charity from other people and actually go out and earn what he does? Two things have come to mind that have helped me come to terms with where my financial resources come from. One is the teaching that Paul gives that the minister of the gospel really is earning it. They are contributing something of very great value to people, to give the truth to people, to make them better off spiritually, is an incredible service. It's an incredible product. It's an incredible thing to do for someone. So if someone supports you physically and materially, as you have given to them spiritually, is a fair exchange, as Paul sees it.
It's like for a physician, they give to help the physical body. You're a physician to the spiritual body.
Right.
And you don't get paid by the hour or by the session or by the appointment. You just get paid more generally.
Yeah, and the way I view it, and this is my second point, actually, the way I view it is I don't really get paid for services rendered, nor would I ever want to do that, because I would never want my offering the gospel to be tied to their paying the fee. It was given to me free. I can hardly not offer it freely to other people. But it's not charity. That is, I don't see what I'm doing. I think that I'm responsible for my financial upkeep. You are not responsible for that. The listeners are not responsible for that. My supporters are not responsible for that. If the money is not coming in, then I would see it as my responsibility to get another job, a different job, a part-time job, whatever, to take care of myself and my family. It's not other people's responsibility. It's my responsibility. So I'm not asking anybody for charity, but I am welcoming the patronage of other people. That is, much like a wealthy person might finance the opera or an artist or a dance troupe or a symphony or something. We have something far more important than a symphony or an art gallery when we're talking about the gospel. And people who see the value of the gospel and therefore see that the contribution I can make to the proclamation of that gospel is valuable, if they want to simply be supporters of that, patrons of that, and support that effort, I don't really have any problem with that. I think that's a very noble thing for them to do, and it's a legitimate thing for them to do, and it's legitimate for me to receive that.
And in the same way, we'd like to ask people to consider to be patrons of Christianity at Work.
Exactly.
If you are interested in this program, if you value it, if it has ministered to you, we encourage you to think about, do you want to give us some financial support?
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.